So we're going to continue our study of Sefer Shmuel Beis, and we're up to Perek Yudalit, chapter 14. And what had happened at the end of Perek Yud Gimel was that Avshalom, David's son, who had committed the murder of his brother, Amnon, ran away. He ran to Geshur, which was a foreign country that he had familial ties to. It was his maternal grandfather, his mother who had converted. Her father was the king of Geshur, and so he was there for 3 years. And the Perek concluded by saying that David had began to kind of miss Avshalom, and he had received some level of comfort over the loss of Amnon, that Amnon had died, you know, something along the lines of time heals wounds. And so we're going to see throughout the entire Perek Yudalit that these feelings that David has to maybe reunite with Avshalom is very complex. And again, the situation, the fact that David had one son kill another son, which took place after that son raped a daughter, it clearly this is not normal family issues, and we can understand why the relationships are complex. So we're beginning Perek Yudalit Pasuk Aleph. Vayeda Yoav ben Tsuria ki lev hamelech al Avshalom. Yoav ben Tsuria, who was David's chief general, also his nephew, right? Tsuria was the sister of David. So Yoav, he knew ki lev hamelech al Avshalom, that the heart of the king was on Avshalom. He knew it. The Radak says that he recognized through some of the words, through some of the conversations that David had with Yoav, underneath the surface, it sounds like David didn't necessarily say the words, I miss Avshalom, I want to be reunited with Avshalom. But Yoav came to that understanding, and Yoav was kind of fearful to bring it up explicitly. And the fact that the majority of this perek is going to be the presentation of Yoav's plan, how to communicate with David over this matter, that off the bat, that kind of highlights how sensitive this was. Because Yoav is a general. Usually a general feels very comfortable talking to his king, again, with respect and throwing in phrases like Avdecha and Hamelech and all of that, that the general should feel very comfortable bringing up a matter. And if that matter is the idea of reuniting the king with his son, you'd expect Yoav to be able to just approach David and say the words. And Yoav feels that he can't. And what's interesting is the Radak uses a term that Yoav was actually afraid. He was afraid of David and afraid of David's reaction, which is not necessarily an emotion that usually, if anything, we've seen David be fearful of Yoav. And so Yoav has these feelings, and he comes up with a plan. What's his plan? Pasuk Beis. Vayishlach Yoav Tekoa. Yoav sends a message or a mission to the city of Tekoa. Vayikach Misham Isha Chachama. And he took from there, he had invited to come from the city of Tekoa, a woman who was described as Isha Chachama, a wise woman. Vayomer Ela, and he said to her, His Ablina, please make yourself like an avel, like a mourner. Vilivshi na bigde avel, and please put on the clothing of a mourner. V'al tasuchi shemen, do not anoint yourself with oil, which is one of the things that you wouldn't do, specific actions that you wouldn't do if you were in mourning, right? One of the practices during the 7 days of mourning would not to anoint yourself with oil.
So that implies there was no Shiva, because if she's 7 days...
Well, first of all, his ablina, he's saying act like you are an avelut.
But would normally is, 7 days, it was not in those days that a person in their seventh day of mourning doesn't go around and walk around.
Correct.
Right, so sitting Shiva is a more modern concept.
No, meaning, correct, Ask your question again, maybe.
Meaning, I'm wondering if the
she's
oil
gonna put on, she's gonna put on the ruse. She's
and
gonna
make it look like she's in her 7 days of mourning. But why would she be walking around and interacting with people if she was in her 7 days of mourning?
Well, she's going to present herself to the king with a specific mission.
Okay. So
and when you see the specific mission, you'll recognize that even if she wasn't going to walk around anywhere, this was a pressing matter.
Okay.
She's going to present it as a matter of life and death.
Okay.
But she's presenting herself as a mourner. You should be this way for many days, you know, for a number of days. Misabelas alames, like someone who would be mourning over a dead person. So he wants her to have the appearance of mourning, and that when eventually, as we'll see very soon, when she presents herself in Yerushalayim to the king, it wouldn't be that it'll be after a couple of days of treating herself like a mourner, so she'll look a little disheveled. She'll look the part. Where's Tekoa, and why is he sending to Tekoa, and who is this woman? So Rashi says that Tekoa is a place that the Gemara tells us that in Tekoa, the city of Tekoa, it was plentiful of olive oil. And that's olive oil is symbolized by chachma, by wisdom. Perhaps the connection is oil is used in the menorah. The menorah represents wisdom. And so Tekoa was known to be a place of wisdom because it was known to be a place of oil.
Mm-hmm.
So there was, if he needed someone wise to go ahead and pull off this plan that's going to be unfolding throughout this parak, and he chooses a woman. Presumably, he knew about this woman. We never find out her name, so we don't know anything about her other than she is a wise woman. If you're trying to figure out where the city is. So there is a city today in Israel known as Tekoa. Tekoa is a little further than Ephrat. So it's in the Gush Etzion region. I can't promise exactly where all the boundaries are. And there is a city that is quoted by Josephus and another, I think it's a contemporary of Josephus, Jerome. They talk about a place being near Beit Lechem, known as Tekoa, and it's a place that has oil, a place known to have olive oil. So near Beit Lechem, again, that's in the tribe. It's in the tribe of Yehuda. A question that I have, I don't have an answer for, homework assignment, is that the Radak says that v'haysa'ir b'chalko shel Asher. The Radak thinks that the city of Tekoa was in the portion of Asher, because the pasuk does say about the portion. The pasuk in Vizos HaBracha, when Moshe Rabbeinu is giving the blessings to the tribes before he passes away. So the pasuk says, "V'tovel b'shemen raglo," that you could kind of, you could like immerse in the oil of his feet, meaning in terms of the portion of Asher. Asher was known for olives, for olive groves, and the ability to grow olives. So the only problem is that it definitely doesn't match up with the modern day Yeshuv of Tekoa is clearly in the tribe of Yehuda.
Mm-hmm.
And how valid the translation is, when the Torah was translated into Greek, the Torah was translated into Greek by 70 Chachamim. Those 70 Chachamim, known as the Septuagint, they translated the five books of the Torah into Greece. That was the first time the Torah was translated. The rest of the Tanakh, the Nevi'im and the Ksuvim, were also translated into Greek at some point, but not by the same individuals. And so the validity, you know, if you had that ancient Greek, so we would all understand that there's definitely something significant to the translation that these 70 Chachamim came up with. It was considered to be a tragic event that they had to translate. They were forced into translating the Torah, but the fact that 70 Talmid Chachamim translated the Torah, and the miracle story is that they all had the same one.
Right.
Which someone pointed out, the greater miracle would have been if they were, because apparently they were secluded,
yeah,
and they wrote 70 translations. Someone said the greater miracle would have been if they were in the same room, and came up with the same translation. But the Tanakh, the Nach, the Nevi'im and the Ksuvim were not translated at that same era, and I don't know if we know for sure who the translation. There's a pasuk in Yehoshua that in the translation of the Septuagint translates has the phrase Tekoa in one of the towns of Yehuda. I didn't see that in the regular Tanakh. I didn't have 100% time to keep looking. It doesn't really make a difference. It's just something fascinating that the Radak seems to say. He's not saying maybe it's in Asher. He's saying, and it's in the tribe of Asher. Asher is much more. If you look at any of the maps of the tribes, it's much more north than. I think we even have it here. Right, just Asher is in the north,
mm-hmm. Right, and clearly,
and Yehuda's down here.
Right.
Beis Lechem is right here. So, and even here, it has Tekoa, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So how did obviously the Radak didn't have the Judaica press maps or whatever they got their maps from,
right, but.
There was a tradition about, I guess, varying tradition. So. I imagine the people in Tekoa today, I imagine they, put the Radak a little bit in parentheses because they probably really want that their Tekoa is this Tekoa, because then it's, then you could, your Israeli tour guide can have his Tanakh and show you and say this is Tekoa. So the Isha Chachama, again, we probably would really want to know who she is because...
Probably, would he have pulled a woman, a wise woman, from all the way up there? Right? Doesn't it make sense that it's near Yerushalayim?
It depends. This seems to be a priority for Yoav to try to reconcile David and Avshalom. And so if it was such a high level priority, then maybe it would be worth it to bring someone from anywhere, even from another country.
So what does a wise woman mean, by the way? What does wise mean? I mean, like, is she a Navi? No. Why does it specify that she's a wise woman?
Well, she's going to have to put on an act. So technically, you could say she just has to be a good actress. But it could very well be that she had to buy in to the overall idea of trying to convince a king of something and using persuade, while Yoav is going to give her what to say, it could very well be what Yoav does is he gave her the outline of what to say. But when it's going to be her in the king's throne room making her persuasive speech to the king, she'll be choosing the individual word. And then David's going to respond back to her, and she needs to be able to have that
on her feet.
Right.
Right.
So she needs to be wise. So presumably it means, to be wise. There is a broader question that we could ask, because I'm kind of spilling the beans that Yoav is trying to get Avshalom back and get David and Avshalom back together. So the question you could ask, why is Yoav interested in reuniting David and Avshalom? So number, you could have a number of theories. Again, we're not going to know any of them to be true for sure. There could be a theory that Yoav thought that Avshalom is an asset to David's kingdom. Meaning, say what you want about Avshalom, but he's a man. He was a man of accomplishment. Besides the fact this error that he made, maybe Yoav says we need him. The other approach is that maybe Avshalom is dangerous. Maybe Avshalom is dangerous, but to have him be dangerous under Yoav's watch versus in a foreign place, and we're going to see in the near future that Avshalom was dangerous. He was dangerous for the stability of David's rule, and so. That theory may be true, and Yoav was right, and that Yoav didn't, in the end, Yoav didn't handle it in total because he didn't keep Avshalom in check. But the motivation may be.
Now, I was going to say, they're also family. I mean,
This is his cousin.
His nephew. Right.
Right. Yoav and Avshalom are cousins.
Right. So you want to keep the family.
Right. It could just be pure. Right. And it could just be. Listen. If you're the general of David, you want what's best for your king. You know, mending a relationship, a very important relationship between a parent and a child, that could be very. You know, you could imagine. You know, some television show about a presidency where the chief of staff makes it a priority to mend the relationship between the president and the president's child, because it's just not good to have you want David's head to be clear to run the country. And in the back of his head, he's thinking about the fact that he has an estranged son who killed his other son. I mean, this is, they didn't have therapy in those days, so you have to imagine that there's now a third the art scroll note here has a third motivation, which sounds a little compelling,
yeah.
In that Yoav also killed out of revenge. Mm-hmm. Yoav's brother was killed. Yoav's brother Asael was killed by Avner, who was the general of Shaul, and Yoav did a revenge killing. And David wasn't happy about it, but basically David had implied that Yoav is just a little too powerful to be dealt with. So Yoav did a revenge killing. Avshalom did a revenge killing, right? His sister was raped by Amnon, and he killed Amnon out of revenge. So if he could bring back, if Yoav could convince David to bring back Avshalom, to some degree it would kind of say that revenge killings can be understood differently than other types of killings. And so it wouldn't be a way of only exonerating Avshalom, but in some way, Yoav may be thinking this will exonerate me. Mm-hmm. So that's a theory.
Right, and then you highlight the fact that David killed Bathsheba's husband, and that was not a revenge killing. That was just a manipulative kind of a thing, right? I guess David probably killed a lot of people in his time, but
right.
I mean, I'm just thinking about the killings that we've read about recently. That was not a revenge killing.
Right. So what's interesting is that in the understanding of this whole part of the episode, we don't really make much mention to what happened with Bathsheba. Mm-hmm. Right? The parak prior to this,
right.
We do. And then when Avshalom is back and causes trouble, which takes place in the next parak, again, we make reference to it being connected to the story. But, you know, these are very complex mm-hmm. stories and themes. So here we have, so he's reached out to this woman, this wise woman, and he tells her to pretend that she's in Avelos, that she's in mourning. And why it chooses the Shemen, meaning we know that there are multiple practices.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I guess, you would say it's the most noticeable, perhaps. You know, let's say a person doesn't take a shower, you know, some people smell, some people don't smell, but if the normal society anoints themselves with oil and she went 3 or 4 days, right? Think about our, you know, makeup. And right, if a lady wouldn't wear makeup for 4 days, it would be noticeable. So that's presumably why.
You're talking to the wrong crowd here.
Yeah.
But in some cases.
No, no, certainly before the king. If she's going
right,
before the king.
Right, she would adorn herself in some way.
Right.
Right.
You go to a wedding every night, you're wearing white
right,
makeup.
That's what I'm saying, right? Like, we would all wear makeup to a wedding.
Right.
I don't know, I still don't.
Right.
It's true.
Right.
Anyway.
I haven't put it on in a couple of days either, so.
But, okay, so the oil. Plus oil is like, you know, the ritual part of oil. I guess women didn't use oil for ritual purposes, did they? Men did. But women didn't use ritual.
Right. I mean, again, I don't know why this is singled out. But again, if he's trying to make her look the part.
Mm-hmm.
The other, I imagine she went with the other practices of mourning as well, in terms of shoes, in terms of that mm-hmm. nature. But why the Tanakh singles this one out,
right.
I didn't see. So, and this now he's continuing the plan in Pasuk Gimel. Uvas el HaMelech, you'll come to the king. V'dibart elav kadavar hazeh, and you will speak to him like this, or like these words. V'yasem Yoav es hadvarim b'fiha, and Yoav put the words in her mouth, meaning he crafted a script, and he gave her the script. Now, did he give her word for word? We don't necessarily know, or
but
did
you
he...
think not, I'm sorry, you think not, because it says kadavar. You know what I'm saying? Like, and you'll speak like this.
Like this, meaning
instead
he's
of
telling
this
her,
thing.
Right?
Like if it's
could
like
be
this thing, it would mean the exact words. But
right.
Like this thing.
Meaning he's going to give her the theme, the theme and the direction
and
the mission.
It. Right. Mm-hmm.
But then she has to own it.
Mm-hmm. Right. And use her.
Also, back to the idea of her being
a smart woman, which is why
is that he gives her the theme and he knows that she can create the whole scenario.
Right. And also, it's to some degree. It's going to be based on David's reactions to what
right,
she says
right.
because
right.
she can't Yoav can't right. you can't script everything mm-hmm. because
you,
it's
you don't know how he'll react.
Exactly. So it's a little bit, I guess like improv.
Exactly.
So she's so the fact that she's an Isha Chachama that gives it the ability to succeed. Pasuk Dalet. Vatomer her Isha Hatkoit El Hamelech. So the woman from Tekoa said to the king, Vatipol al apeha, she fell on her face, arza to the ground, vatishtachu, she bowed down, vatomer, and she said, Hoshi'a hamelech, save, O king, save me, O king. So some of the Farshim are bothered by the fact that it says vatomer and vatomer. The first part of the pasuk says, and she said. Then she bows down and she said. So some understand that she didn't get a chance to speak to the king right away. She first spoke to the king's guards or whoever accepts people, and that didn't go her way. Finally, she somehow made it in front of the king. She bowed down and immediately turned to the king and said, Hoshi'a HaMelech, save me, O king. Pasukei, Vayomer la HaMelech, so the king said to her, Malach, what's with you? Why are you here? What's your problem? Vatomer, and she said, Aval, and here the word Aval, the Mitzvah Tzion, and Rashi says it means the word in truth. Mm-hmm. Aval, in truth, Isha Almana Ani. In truth, I am a widow. Vayamas Ishi, and my husband has died. It could very well be that this part was actually true. Meaning, we're about to see that the main part, in the next pasuk, we're going to see that the main part of her dialogue with David has to do with her talking about her sons. But it could very well be that this part was true, and it's always easier to act something that's partially, partially true. If you, Lahavdil, because this is Tanakh, but if you, you were making a film about people from Brooklyn, and one of the actors was actually from Brooklyn, it's going to be easier to get into that role. So she says, I am an Isha Almana, I'm a widow. Vayamasi Ishi, my husband has died. Pasuk Vav. Uleshiv Chasacha Shnei Vanim. And to your maidservant, so she's speaking about herself in a very humble way, which makes sense. Shnei Vanim, I had two sons. Vayinatsu Shnehem Basadeh, and they were fighting, they were quarreling in the field. The Ein Ish, or the Ein Matzil Benehem. Nobody came to rescue between them. Vayakuha Achad Esa Achad Vayamasoso. One struck the other, and one killed the other. So this is not true. This she's making up. Yoav told her to make up this story about sons, where one killed the other son. The goal is to somehow send a message about David's situation, where he had one son who killed another son. Where the pasuk says, "Ve'ein matzil beinehem," there was no one to save between them. Perhaps that phrase is there to highlight the role that David played. What role did David play? The role that he didn't play was the role that he played. David did never, right? There were 2 years between Amnon's crime of the rape of Tamar and Avshalom taking the revenge killing of Amnon. What did David do in those 2 years to intervene? Now, there wasn't a fight. We said that Avshalom wouldn't even talk good things or bad things. He wouldn't talk at all to Amnon. But what did David do? Did David potentially could have punished Amnon to a degree that would have satisfied Avshalom? David could have reached out to Avshalom, perhaps. So maybe this, so, right, if she's trying to send, she's going to try to be convincing David that it's time to bring back your son. One of the ways is to view that, David could view that he's partially responsible for what happened. Not, obviously it wasn't, he didn't tell Avshalom to tell his servants to kill Amnon, but that, and in the back of your mind you might be thinking, first of all, David could also think, this whole thing happened, right? Why did this whole thing go into motion? The whole story of Amnon and Tamar goes into motion as a consequence of the of David's active story with Bathsheba. So that meaning, so perhaps this is a hint of saying that David should take some ownership of what took place, to the extent that now at least it's been 3 years that Avshalom's exiled. Bring him back. So this woman is telling her story, that she had two sons who fought, and unfortunately one son killed the other son. Pasuk Zayin, which is obviously it's a clearly a complex situation that you can't really wrap your mind around. Meaning, I would imagine there's not one if any time in history that happened. So parents could have one of two reactions. They could have a reaction of utter disgust, of never wanting to have anything to do with the murderous son, mm-hmm. or somehow, because things are complicated and you know there's so much emotional connection between a mother and a son, that she's willing to still have a relationship with her son who killed her other son. No one would be able to say which feeling is, it's a person's emotions. So she's going to take one side of it.
If he had gone to that dinner, would that have prevented the killing?
I mean, right? If David had gone?
Yeah,
or,
like
David
Avshalom had invited David first.
If he had,
to the dinner,
presumably, presumably it wouldn't have happened then.
Right?
We had presented it that
kings wouldn't go.
That Avshalom knew that.
Right.
And he kind of lured David into like feeling bad that he's not going, so that he'll be more likely to send Amnon.
Right. Yeah.
Right. That's another thing.
Looking at that, maybe he should have gone. You know.
Another thing. Right. So this is all, and it's not to make necessarily David feel guilty, because that probably won't help at all. It's to somehow add some understanding that what Avshalom did in killing Amnon was wrong, and we're going to hint to it. But the punishment is not you putting him to death, and the punishment is not banishment. Or the punishment is that he did something wrong without witnesses, and God has to punish him. And, you know, we believe in a just and merciful God, and God will punish. But it's not David's job to punish. So she says the two things happened. That right? Her husband had already passed away. Mm-hmm. She has two sons, and it sounds like she only has two sons. And son number one killed son number two. Pasuk Zayin. V'hine kama kol ha-mishpacha al shivchasecha. And behold, all of the family, all of my family, the entire family, has rose up against your maidservant, has rose up against me. Vayomru, and they say, Tini esmake achiv, give over the one who struck his brother, v'nimisehu benefesh achiv asher harag, and we will kill him, right? We'll take it into our own hands to be, you know, revenge killers for the life that he took. V'nashmida gamas hayoresh, and they would, and we will destroy the yoresh, the one who would inherit, because this, so the surviving son is now the sole inheritor of the brother he killed and the father who has died. But with the way she presents it is v'chibu es gachalti asher nish'ara, and they, but by doing that they will extinguish the coal, the gachal that is left over, their last remaining coal, l'dilti sim l'ishi shame, taking away the name of my husband, usheiris al pnei adama, and a remnant on the face of this, on the face of the earth, that the right, that if you know, she may even be saying, say what you want about this son who murdered, but if we allow him to live and we allow him to marry, he will have children. And those children won't be bad. Those children will be my husband's legacy.
Right.
Specifically the shame, we know that the whole entity of the Torah's description of Yibum, mm-hmm. that if a man dies without children, that his brother is supposed to marry his widowed sister-in-law, is that the first child will be somehow considered to be the brother's child. Biologically, it won't, but on some spiritual level, the fact that the brother is stepping up to the plate, it'll be like the child is carrying on the name of the deceased, and the Tanakh specifically with men seems to put a great focus that the man wants to leave a legacy to kind of be remembered, that his idea of the name going on. Some people even say that's the essence of the word zachar, that for a male zachar means to be remembered. Which is something that, you know, so she's appealing to David in the story by saying, this son who murdered, so the family wants him, the family wants to have some type of revenge killing. But by doing that, now there's a little bit of a hint that maybe they have ulterior motives, because she's talking about there being no inheritor. Well, if there's no inheritor, who's going to inherit? If they do this revenge killing, who would they wouldn't? Meaning, there's always family to inherit. If it doesn't, right? So
because she wouldn't, the wife wouldn't, the widow, whatever.
The wife, if the husband dies, so she'll receive her ksuba payment. She'll receive money from the estate as one of the financial obligations, but she doesn't inherit her husband halakhically, unless he...
Even if there's no kids, you're saying?
Even if there's no kids. It goes to his father and father's brother. It goes up.
Hmm.
So and obviously we're in this fake story, but she's hinting that even in their revenge killing, the mishpacha might have ulterior motives.
Is that what they do in Israel if there's no will?
So I don't know. What I do know is that Israeli law is one of the most complex legal systems to understand, because it's a mishmash of Israeli law, whatever that is, Torah law,
right,
like Byzantine law, Turkish law, British law. It's quite complex. In a Torah society, we would organize it that way, unless someone, now they, what we call a halach, if someone writes what's called a halachic will, is where you stipulate that you don't want your assets to be divided according to the laws of the Torah.
It's almost like an anti-halachic will.
Correct, but in terms of keeping peace and families, right, so if a person has sons and daughters, so only their sons are supposed to inherit,
right.
It doesn't go well today. So the halachic will is a way of saying, you know, listen, sons, you have two choices. You either owe your sisters $10 million, and that's a chov, that's a debt that I owe them. So first pay that, and then you could divide according to the Torah. But for most people, they'll be left with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Or instead, I'll cancel, your sisters are willing to cancel that debt, or I'm willing to cancel that debt if you divide it equally amongst yourselves. That would be a way to also go around. The Torah tells us we need to give a firstborn two portions.
Right.
Right, you take the amount. Let's say there are four sons. I'm one of four sons, so you take. How do you get? And there's a bechor.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get? Right, so you make it into five portions,
God, right.
And he gets two.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone gets 20%, and he gets 40%.
But they don't do that now. If there's no will, you don't know if they do that.
If there's no will, so if there's no...
In America,
we're bound by America.
The wife would inherit.
We're bound by American law. I don't know what...
No, I'm saying in Israel.
I don't... It's whatever modern-day
right.
Israeli law
but it's
is.
It's not for sure Torah law.
Because nothing, to some degree we say, unfortunately, nothing is.
Not like divorce is.
Yeah, you know, there are... there are some there are some areas that are more guided by Torah, but from what I remember, it's a little complex because
well, the get probably is because the offspring then of that woman after specifically
marriage.
You can rationalize anything. I mean, marriage just annulled the Beit Din. I don't remember where in which city in Israel just finally they annulled some marriage where the husband ran away.
Mm-hmm.
Marriage, divorce, and conversion were given over to the Rabbanut to run according to halacha. I mean, Israeli law basically gave it over to that. You know, and who knows if 70 years ago, you know, if they knew what was happening today, they might not have. You know, for all we know, they were thinking that 70 years later there won't be any Orthodox rabbis anyway, so they won't there won't be a Rabbanut.
Right.
They weren't thinking that.
They probably moved a little
Right, but no one ever thought that Orthodoxy was going to grow in Israel. The founders of the state didn't envision that.
Right.
So, but again, it's complex. So here, she's basically pleading to David. I need to protect this son. They have no right to kill him, and it follows the same pattern as the story with Avshalom, meaning one son killed another son without witnesses and without warning.
Mm-hmm.
Was when a killing takes place without witnesses and without warning, a revenge killing is not allowed. Now, we understand the motivation why they want to, but it's not allowed, and she's all alone. She doesn't have her husband to kind of protect her son. And so she's reaching out to the king. And this is a plausible story that a woman would come to the king. That's what, a Jewish king is not there just to, any king is not there just to lead battles. It's there to provide stability in the country. And this is her king. Vayomer ha-melech el ha-isha. So the king says to the woman, L'chi leveseich, go home, va'ani atzaveh alayich, and I will command concerning you. Meaning, that's David's way of saying, I'm going to help you. That I'm going to issue a command concerning you, meaning I'm going to, edict of protection, or
witness protection program.
You're right. I'm going to step in. The government can protect someone.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to protect your son. When David says that, he's opening a door for her. Because David's basically saying, I understand that, yes, your son is a murderer, but he should not be handled in the way that your family wants to handle him because of the circumstances, because there's no witnesses, because there's no warning, because that's not the appropriate punishment. So therefore, in the back of her mind, Yoav's plan is working because that's Avshalom. Vatomer ha'isha ha'tkoit el ha'melech. So the woman from Tekoa says to the king, Alai Adoni Hamelech Ha'avon Va'al Beis Avi. Upon me, my master the king, will the sin be, and upon my father's house. The Hamelech V'chiso Naki, and the king and his throne are innocent. Mefarshim understand this pasuk to be, she was trying to say that if something happens to her son, it's going to be on me. But it's her way of saying she's saying it almost in what we call a lashon naki. She's trying to say that David, you really need to be taking responsibility for this. And I want it to be that if something, God forbid, happens to my son, you're willing to take responsibility. But she doesn't want to say that because that's disrespectful. So she says that if something would happen to my son, it'll be, right, Alai ha'avon va'al beis avi, va'amelech v'chiso naki, the melech would be clean, meaning that's her way of saying that if you're doing this, David, king, then you're taking total responsibility. Pasuk Yod. Vayomer ha'melech. So the king said, Hamedaber elayich vaveso elai. Whoever speaks to you, and meaning speaks to you poorly about your son, vaveso elai, bring them to me. Right? And even if I imagine it means that he's giving some type of power to her to have some type of assistant, meaning...
Right, she can't just on her own.
Drag someone. Right. But it means that you'll have the right to call the local... Right, there were... Right, In Parsha Shoftim, in Sefer Devarim, so the Pasuk says, Shoftim v'shotrim titein l'chol sh'aracha. There'll be judges and officers in all of your gates. Meaning the every city in Israel had police officers. Halachic, police, the Torah, society needs police officers. Mm-hmm. So, Vaveso Elai, you can bring them to me. V'lo Yosef od l'gasbach. And that person will no longer harm you. Now, that sounds like a real threat. So it could be that person, either David's going to somehow punish that person, or just the fact when you get brought before the king and you're told by the king, don't verbally assault this woman again. So generally, you listen. So he's continuing to buy into her story by saying that he's willing to, anyone who bothers her, bring them into the, you know, bring them to me and I will reprimand them. It means he's totally in on her story. Pasuk Yud Aleph, Vatomer, so she says, Yiskar na hamelech es Hashem Elokecha, may the king remember Hashem, your God, may harbas goel hadam l'shaches, so that they don't destroy my son, right? Goel hadam is the one who wants to redeem blood. L'shaches, to destroy, v'lo yashmidu, another language of destruction, as b'ni, my son. Vayomer, he says, chai Hashem, by Hashem's life, meaning taking an oath by Hashem, im yipol misaras b'neich arza, if either, even one hair, even a hair of your son falls to the ground. So she was continuing to enlist him in a shvua, which you might say is a little bit... first blush, you might say it's a little bit chutzpahdik. Like the king already gave you his word. Right? He needs to take a shvua in the name of Hashem.
Maybe that's what, what's his name, told her to do.
Yoav,
like that was the important thing.
Right. But it could be she's trying to make his thought process about this whole situation religious. Right. She wants it to be a religious component. Because the idea of keeping the idea of keeping Avshalom away and the idea of wanting to punish Avshalom does not necessarily come from a religious point of view. It comes from an emotional point of view, which is understandable.
Right.
But by bringing God into the picture, she's implying that you should be thinking more about what is the right thing from a religious perspective in this situation. Pasuk Yud Beis. Vatoma Ha'isha. So now the woman says... Batomarisha, she says, "Tadaber na shevchascha el Adoni haMelech davar." Can I talk to you now? Vayomer Dabri, he says, "Speak." You have to imagine that David's. What could she possibly want? She's been talking to him, and she basically sounded like she requested the thing that's most meaningful to her. She's requesting the life of her son, and so what is it? And so, but now she has something to say. Now we know what she has to say. Because now that she hooked David, now's the time, right? She presented the mashal, she presented the parable, and now it's time to weave a nimshal. It's time to explain the what it's really talking about. Vayomer Daberi, he says to her to speak, because that's only right. She's asking if she could speak more. And David's been gracious up until this point. Why would he not continue to be gracious? Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vatomer, she said, Vatomer Isha, the woman said, V'lama chashavta kazos al am Elokim. Why do you think such things about God's people? Umidaber hamelech hadaber hazeh ka'ashem. Umidaber Hamelech Adavar Hazek Hashem, and that the king would be saying that this thing is Hashem, this thing is some type of sin, of mistake. Levilti Hashiv Hamelech Es Nidcho, in order for the king not to return Es Nidcho, the one that he pushed away. Our language is a little bit cryptic. Is that V'lama chashavta kazos al am Elokim? Why have you suspected? Why do you think such a thing about the people of God?
Meaning her, the story with her kids killing the other,
or the fact that her relatives want to kill the second son, the son who killed, even though there were no witnesses and there were no warning.
Okay.
Why are you thinking along those lines? Meaning, of course, that's not the reaction that someone should have to that story, is not to become a vigilante, is not to punish this person who killed in the way that is being presented, to kill them back.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the king is speaking about protecting the supposed son, but at the same time, levilti hashiv hamelech es nidcho, at the same time, the king is not returning the one that's pushed away is Avshalom. Kimos namus, Pasuk Gedalet. She says, Kimos namus, we all die. V'chamayim hanigarim arza, like water that's kind of dragged or flowing on the ground, asher lo yaseifu, that you can't gather it up. That someone who, almost saying that someone who dies is no longer alive, and there's no way to change that. V'lo yisa Elokim nefesh, Hashem doesn't lift up any soul, meaning Hashem doesn't allow anyone not to die. V'chashav machashavos, so therefore you should think, levilti yidach mimenu nidach, so that no one should be pushed away from him. So she's saying a number of thoughts in this kind of cryptic language. To say that everybody dies, she may be implying that Amnon died. Eventually he was going to die. And you can't bring Amnon's life back. It's like water dragging on the floor. You can't bring Amnon's life back, which happens to be, it's obviously clear that you can't bring someone back, but that's something that David had expressed. David had expressed that when he was praying for the life of the baby in the episode with David and Bathsheba, and there's a baby. So we said that when the baby was sick and alive, David was praying around the clock on the floor, and then when the baby finally died, David resumed normal activity. And when his servants kind of said, you know, why are you not mourning, he basically said that while the child was still alive, there was a chance. But once the child was gone, that's it. V'lo yisa Elokim nefesh, God doesn't spare anyone from dying. Maybe a hint that the same way that God doesn't spare anyone from dying, God won't spare Avshalom. Meaning, Avshalom is going to get his due for the actions that he took. But that v'chasha machshavos levilti yidach mimenu nidach, that you should be thinking thoughts that no one should be banished. So no one should be banished, meaning that Avshalom shouldn't be banished. Pasuk Tesvav, Yata, and now, Asher Basi Ladaber El Amelech Adoni Asadaber Hazeh. The reason that I came to to talk to you about this manner or in this manner, ki yir'uni ha'am, because people frightened me. People frightened me in the sense that it's not people who frightened me, it's the king who frightens me. Meaning, why did I come to you and why did I tell you the story that I told you? Because I, right, and we know that it's Yoav pushing her, but people are afraid to talk to the king straight. Here uni ha'am, the people are afraid. Vatomer shevchaska, your maidservant said, Adabra na el ha-melech, I'm going to speak now to the king. Ulay aseh ha-melech es devar amaso, and maybe the king would do what his maidservant wants. Pasuk Tazayin, ki yishma ha-melech lahatzil amaso mikafa ish, for the king would listen to save the maidservant from a man. Lashmido siv es bani yachad, to the man who wants to destroy me and my son together, minachlas elokim, from the heritage of Hashem. Meaning, by telling you this story, I got you to buy in, and therefore, this was the way for it to work. And I was too afraid to do it any other way. Pasuk Yud-Zayin, Vatomer Shevchascha. Your maidservant said, Yena devar Adoni Hamelech l'menucha, the word of my master the king should find some type of menucha, some type of rest or tranquility, meaning for the relationship that you have with your son. Ki kemalach Elokim kein Adoni Hamelech, like an angel of God, that is like my master the king. Lishmoa hatov v'ara, to listen to the good and the bad. V'Hashem Elokecha yimach, and may Hashem be with you. She perhaps is hinting when she says that he's like a malach. So what's a malach? A malach doesn't have emotions. A malach doesn't have desires, right? It's the famous Gemara when in Masechah Shabbos, when Hashem was about to give the Torah, that the angels basically said, you know, like, how dare you give this Torah to Moshe? He's born, he's a human. So Hashem told Moshe, you know, answer back to the angels. So the Gemara, it's a powerful Gemara. The Gemara says, Hashem told Moshe, grab onto my throne and you'll be able to talk back to the angels. And Moshe Rabbeinu basically, he said to the angels, you know, do you have a desire for meat and milk? That the Torah says you should stay away from meat and milk. Do you have a desire for that? Do you have the emotions that the Torah tells us to, and the feeling? That's not what an angel is. So she's saying, you're like an angel, meaning you have the ability to suspend your emotions. And the attitude that you have right now towards Avshalom is coming from an emotional standpoint. It's not coming from a legal or rational or religious standpoint. So she's almost hinting that you're like a malach. And she ends with a bracha, saying that Hashem should be with you. And maybe again, you would say the idea is bringing Hashem and bringing religion into the picture. So David fell for it, but that doesn't necessarily mean that David is upset that it took place this way. But David is, he is already, you have to imagine that he's wondering, you know, who are you? Where do you come from? Who put you up to this kind of thing? And so Bezrim will continue with that.